Welcome to Twist, This Week in Sea Turtles.
All right, I'd like to welcome everybody to Twist, This Week in Sea Turtles. I'd like to first note that I have completely stolen this idea from Leo Laporte and friends, who host a show called Twit, which is This Week in Tech, a show pretty much for geeks that I listen to. Surprise, surprise. This is our second time trying this. The first time we tried this, Matthew noted that we are all turtle geeks, which is why we're doing this. So with me is Matthew Godfrey. He is the Sea Turtle Coordinator for the state of North Carolina, and Manjula Tiwari, who is a research scientist with NOAA in San Diego, National Fisheries Service. Is that right, National Fisheries Service?
That's right.
Okay. And I am Michael Coyne. I run seaturtle.org. I'm also a research scientist at Duke University. And that's it.
Aren't you also president of the ISTS?
That's correct. I have the honor and distinction of being the president of the ISTS, which means I get to host the next symposium. So for those that haven't heard yet, that will be in Myrtle Beach last week of February 2007. So hopefully you can all be there. And actually, now that Matthew brings that up, one of the things that we want to use this outlet for, or that I want to use it for, is to make periodic announcements. So you can find special nowhere else heard announcements about the symposium and other events, hopefully.
And other geeky events.
Other geeky events, yes. Turtle geeky events. So with that, just a little bit of what we're trying to do here. We're not really sure what we're trying to do. This is an experiment. As I said, there's a couple of other podcast-type things that I listen to that I really enjoy. It seems like a good way to foster discussion and to share information. So we're going to try to talk about some issues that are current events in the sea turtle world, maybe some recent papers, recent scientific papers, and occasionally try to get some guests on to discuss some of those items, perhaps, and maybe one or two other people besides myself, Manjula, and Matthew. So with that, you guys have anything to add?
Nope.
No? Nope.
Okay. So we'll go ahead and start with the first topic again. Matthew?
Okay.
Now that you've practiced. I should say this is not Matthew's fault. I messed up the audio the first time, so we're having to actually record this again. So this may sound a little, routine, rote?
Oh, it's nobody's fault.
And if you don't like anything you hear here, it's my fault because I talked these guys into doing this. But go figure. I thought about this the other day. You guys are, between the three of us, we're the most active in doing blogs. The blogs on seaturtle.org. That must say something about our personality.
That's right. Or our level of geekiness.
Right. One or the other. So, sorry, Matthew, go ahead.
Okay. No, I just thought a topic that would be topical is the recent change in the red listing of the Mediterranean green turtle, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So just a little bit of a background. The Red List is published by the IUCN, which is the World Conservation Union. And it's basically a list of relative extinction of different species. And it's it basically lists those species that are considered to have a high risk of global extinction. So things that are vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered. And they these lists are updated every couple of years. I'm not sure exactly how many years between updates, but they just came out with the 2006 update, and it had a change for the Mediterranean green turtle. And just a bit of background to that.
Wait, can I interrupt for a second, Matthew?
Sure.
So you say they're supposed to be updated every 2 years.
That yeah,
just means
I think
a new list comes out every 2 years.
Yeah, let's see, I think when a species is listed on the red list, it has to be reassessed, its categorization or classification has to be reassessed every I want to say 10 years. I'm not exactly sure on the timing of all this, but I think it's every 10 years. Of course, new species or species are put on the red list at different times, so you get this turnover at different rates for different species. So every 2 years, we'll pick up the update. Every 2 years, we'll pick up any changes that have occurred in the previous 24 months to different species according to their assessments.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes. So for sea turtles, it's not done every 5 years?
See, I'm not too sure on the timing. I think it's every 10 years, but it could be every 5 years. I'm not exactly sure. It's an evolving process, actually, and it seems to be at a little bit of flux right now.
Okay.
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 So the 2006 red list was just released, and you can search it online at www.redlist.org. And if you go on there and type in sea turtle or marine turtle, you'll see that all seven species are listed on there, including that they're all listed as either endangered or critically endangered, except for the flatback, which is listed as data deficient. And that just means that there aren't enough data available to do a formal evaluation. But it doesn't mean that it's not worthy of conservation or anything like that. It just means there's not enough information available yet to do a proper classification. The interesting thing about the red list is that it's designed to look at globally distributed species or look at the species level. It's not really designed to look at population level or regional level or subpopulation level. And although there are exceptions to that, and one of the exceptions was the Mediterranean green turtle, that was listed separately as critically endangered. On a global level, green sea turtles are listed as just endangered, but for some reason, in 1996, I believe it was, the Mediterranean green turtle subpopulation was listed separately as critically endangered. And there has been discussion over the past year or so about why is that the case.
Where did that come from?
Where did it come from?
Yeah, I mean, it just came out on the list all of a sudden?
Yeah, apparently it did, and I think Manjula had asked this question before. What were the criteria or the data for that? And no one's quite sure. There's not really a paper trail for some of the older classifications available for people to look at. And that's, again, something that's changing, improving in the process. As of right now, any new assessments or classifications have to have a complete paper trail available for anybody to review if they want to.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes,
what
please.
Sort of criteria did they use for the Mediterranean green turtle? The same as for their global listing, or?
Yes, but again, it's one of those things where we don't really know because we don't have the paperwork or the justification available to look at. So, but one assumes that they did use the same criteria that are used for global populations.
So there's not an actual paper assessment that anybody can refer to, like the one that Jeff Semenoff did for recently, right, for green turtles?
Yeah, for green turtles.
No, in fact, the one Jeff recently did for green turtles is the only one that exists that documents everything. There is one for the hawksbill turtle that was published in 99 for the assessment that was done in 96, but that's not complete. It doesn't have all the supporting documentation attached to it, so it's very difficult to adequately assess. But Jeff Semenoff's recent assessment really sets the standard for making sure everything is presented and transparent and all
right.
The data that were considered are available.
Yeah, it was an extremely thorough job.
Yeah.
And that's available for everybody to see, right? On the
that's
NTSG
right.
Website.
That's on the NTSG website. And in fact, if you go on the redlist.org website and search for green turtle, you'll see down at the bottom there's a link to Jeff's assessment for anybody to look at.
Right. Right. And the Marine Turtle Specialist Group website is IUCN-MTSG.org, and you can find that there.
Yep. Yeah. So the big change. So there's been all this discussion about, well, why if the red list, IUCN red list, normally only contains global species evaluations, why is there this subpopulation of the Mediterranean green turtle and other species and other subpopulations too? But why in particular is the green turtle in the Mediterranean listed separately from the green turtle globally? And what are the, you know, what were the reasons for that? And if there are no good reasons, then maybe it should be taken off. And in fact, we just heard, I think it was 3 days ago, from the chair, or the co-chair of the MTSG, which is the Marine Turtle Specialist Group, which is part of the IUCN, the World Conservation Union. We just heard that, in fact, that they decided to take the Mediterranean green turtle out of the red list. So it's no longer listed there, because there's not enough supporting information. And if in the future, if someone wants to do a separate assessment and it comes through that it should be listed as endangered or critically endangered or whatever, then that can change. But the way things stand right now, there aren't sufficient enough data available to properly list it in the red list.
I was actually curious to know what the people in the region in the Mediterranean thought of the delisting, because I was wondering if it would affect things such as funding.
Do you think, I mean, it doesn't change the fact that globally the green turtle is listed as endangered, right? There's that. And secondly, there was some discussion at the recent Marine Turtle Specialist Group meeting about whether or not we should be using the IUCN Red List categorization as in endangered or critically endangered as some kind of tool for getting more funding or things like that.
Uh-huh. And what were the thoughts on that?
There are some people who, well, I should say probably all of us consciously or subconsciously use the red list classification to our benefit. We always preface our publications or our reports that say, oh, the green turtle's endangered, oh, the leatherback is critically endangered. So we all use it. But there are some people that think that we probably shouldn't do that, because if we use it as a tool, that means it's to our benefit to keep it that way, and that really shouldn't inform the process. Our needs to have it like that shouldn't inform how the process evolves. There's been some talk about trying to dissociate that, and in fact, the IUCN is pretty clear that the red list is not policy. The classification of animals on the red list shouldn't drive policy. It should help form policy, but it shouldn't drive policy. So if a species is listed as endangered, it doesn't mean that you can't do anything to it. It just means that it faces a risk of extinction, and there should be management or conservation to help it, but it doesn't cut off all different possibilities, such as sustainable use and things like that.
So, any additional protections at the international level or anything like that that comes along with an animal being listed on the red list? I mean, what's the benefit of being listed on the red list, other than just sort of, you know, being made publicly, just being public information and letting people know that that's the case?
Yeah, I guess there are some countries that defer to the IUCN red list and use that to classify for their national laws the threat category for species that occur in their territories.
Right.
Not every country does that, of course. The U.S., Canada, Brazil, European countries, they all have their own separate listing processes. They will take information that is available from the IUCN, but they won't rely specifically or totally on the red list to make their own assessments. But it does influence, I would say, how animals are listed at the, or species are listed at the national level.
Right.
And it also does have some relationship to CITES, although it doesn't, the classifications of the red list don't necessarily correspond directly to CITES appendices, CITES being the Convention for International Trade on Endangered Species, which is another convention to protect animals that are threatened with extinction.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to a point that you made a second ago, is it realistic to think that you're going to get people to stop using the red list classification, say, in their publications or proposals that they're writing? I mean, that's sort of an individual decision, and clearly makes a point when somebody is writing a proposal or writing a paper. You know, it's just you were talking about, you know, the idea of separating those two things, that we're sort of in a mindset of perpetuating the red listing because, you know, it helps us get funding or it helps us get papers published or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah,
it seems a bit strange.
No, I think that's a really good point, and it's I think it's one that all of us who work with species that are listed as endangered or threatened with extinction or things like that, that we really need to reflect upon. That, you know, for myself, my job is funded primarily on the basis of the fact that sea turtles are listed as threatened or endangered in the U.S. And if they weren't, then there probably wouldn't be as much funding available to fund my job or some of the things that we do. And so it's I think there are issues of objectivity and things like that that all of us have, should definitely reflect upon.
Well, I think it's unrealistic to expect that people aren't going to take advantage of, you know, something like a red list in mm-hmm. those situations.
Right.
But I think maybe the thing, this sort of highlights the importance of having these assessments done in a timely manner and having them done very thoroughly. You know, what Jeff Siminoff did, you know, as an excellent example.
Right.
It just highlights, I think, the importance of having, you know, this very thorough and transparent job done on assessing where these animals are so that proper classifications can be made.
Right. I kind of see the removal of the Mediterranean green turtle from the IUCN red list as sort of a first step in the process of improving the entire red list classification system for globally distributed species like sea turtles. You know, Jeff did a great job on the most recent green turtle assessment, but I still think that it's not the best way to go about classifying sea turtles. And in fact, I think probably the assessment itself is wrong. I don't think that green turtles globally should be listed as endangered.
There's the certain populations. I guess we should mention that this has been a hot topic of discussion for several years. That it's difficult to make global pronouncements when some populations are declining and others are increasing.
Right. So it's not just doing the assessment thoroughly, but it's also doing the assessment, I think, well, which is really difficult to do considering that you're supposed to come up with strong or hard data from three generations ago, which works out to be something like 180 years ago, which is, you know, you can imagine the difficulties with that.
Right.
So...
So now, I thought my understanding was that the red list process did not have any mechanism for dealing with regional classifications, but then we have the Mediterranean, or we had the Mediterranean listing. Is that the case?
Yeah. Well, it's the IUCN, the actual red list itself that's published every 2 years, or an update is published every 2 years. The red list authority prefer that they do not include regional populations or subpopulations or national populations. They just want the global species in there. The thing is, though, is that they recognize that some groups or regions might want to apply their criteria to smaller levels or more localized levels, like mm-hmm. at the region, like the Mediterranean. So they do have criteria available for people to use if they wanted to classify at the regional level. They just and you're free to do that. It's just that they won't take that assessment at the regional level and publish it in the IUCN red list.
Right.
I mean, was that the case with the Mediterranean green turtle?
Yeah. See, again, I don't know. I don't know how that all worked out. Nobody's quite sure how that happened, how it got in there. But the good news is that it's out. It's out of the red list now. It's definitely sticking to the way it should be, I think.
What do you mean by that, the way it should be?
Yeah, well, that's what I didn't understand either.
Sorry. The red list, if it's only for global populations, then it shouldn't include these regional populations
But you said that they do have some provisions for doing regional listings, although that's not included in their main publication, right?
That's right. They have recommendations or guidelines available for people to use if they want to do, you know, the Marine Turtle Specialist Group decided that they did in fact want to do an assessment of the Mediterranean green turtle population using the IUCN red list criteria, then those criteria are available with guidelines for how to use them on a regional level. I still think, personally, I think that the problems that face the global listing still apply at the regional level if you use the same criteria. And this, there's actually a movement within the Marine Turtle Specialist Group, which is responsible for doing the assessments, actually, the global assessments for IUCN. There's a move to go towards regional assessments for marine turtles, which is great. I think that's more realistic. They would still do the global assessments, but then afterwards do regional assessments. Mm-hmm. But the issue is that it's not a quick fix. They still have to come up with a way of dealing with this three generations ago, this 180 years ago, or whatever it is, depending on the species. And until they fix that,
you mean for the regional listings?
Yeah. Because if they just apply it,
but wait, so I guess I'm not following one thing. So if we do our regional listings, it still won't be along the lines of what IUCN wants, right? Because they want global assessments. They haven't gone towards regional assessments. It's something that we want to do.
Right. Yes, that's right.
So, we're not bound to the three generations thing, then, are we?
Exactly. Although, if you go by the guidelines made available by the IUCN for regional listings, that it does include the three generation thing. So, we as a group, as the Marine Turtle Specialist Group, we have to come up with an alternative method of doing regional assessments, which no one has really talked about to date. They've just talked about moving away from global to regional. And I still think that we've got a huge hurdle or a series of hurdles to get through before we come up with some rational and realistic ways of doing regional head listing. And I should say also that there are other specialist groups that do use alternative methods for assessing their populations, whether it's global or regional. For instance, the Crocodile Specialist Group pretty much uses its own set of criteria to do listings, at least for certain species. So mm-hmm. precedent has been set by other specialist groups that we definitely should look into, and I think we need to move towards coming up with our own set of criteria.
Well, that seemed to be the discussion the last couple of MTSG meetings I've been to. It seems to be sort of a general consensus, not complete consensus.
Yeah,
that is a preferred way to deal with it with sea turtles.
Right.
I mean, did you get that impression as well?
Me?
Yeah. Well, either of you, both of you.
Yeah, I think in general, I would think that most people would agree that a regional assessment would be more worthwhile than a global assessment.
Right. Well, I mean, for the very reason that I mentioned before, you've got some populations that are declining, and you've got others that are increasing. So, how can you?
Right.
How can you automatically say that, you know, all the populations or the global population is in decline or endangered?
Yeah,
when clearly some populations are not.
Right. And it's definitely going to be a complicated process, because in addition to setting criteria for determining the status of a species, I mean, we would need to identify a region.
Right.
You know, and then the question, I mean, the main question is how do you identify
a leech? Right. And it gets, you know, terribly confusing with sea turtles because,
right.
I mean, they're transnational, they're transoceanic, they're, you know, so how do you protect, you know, how do you set a regional classification? You know, what's the region? I guess it varies by population, I suppose.
Right.
Well, I guess you could start off at the ocean basin level, maybe.
Right.
And try it there. But, you know, I think that they should, what we should do as a group is we should just list all the species as data deficient at the global level. Because clearly we don't have the information needed to do an accurate assessment 180 years ago. And then just move directly to regional assessments, however we decide to do that, using different criteria.
So would you say that it would be easiest to start with the Mediterranean? To get away with...
Well, it would probably be best to start wherever we have the best information, the most comprehensive and long-term information. I don't know, where would that be?
No, I think that's a really good question, Manjula. I have no idea where the best place to start would be. Maybe green turtles, actually, given the work that Archie Carr started so many years ago in Tortuguero, and green turtles in the Atlantic,
maybe. You're suggesting
that
green turtles in the Atlantic rather than green turtles, say, in the Caribbean.
Well, you know, this is what Michael was saying. How do you define what a region is or a subpopulation? And these are all issues that have to be worked out.
Right. And with some of these species, you know, the leatherback, if you're going to list leatherback in the Atlantic, you've basically, the region would be the entire Atlantic because they range throughout.
Yeah.
And loggerheads, you know, appears that they do the same. And then if you're looking at all life history stages, then, you know, they get the same sort of thing.
But in terms of places rather than species, wouldn't the Mediterranean be the best place to start? Since, you know, they already have some precedence with this formal listing.
But there's no paper trail, right? so it doesn't really help.
You know, in a way, that's good because, you know, it lets you have a fresh start.
Right. But you don't have that, you don't have that help, that the helping start that you were talking about.
Yeah. Only, I mean, in terms of defining a region, I was just wondering whether, yes, certainly there is exchange in, you know, in animals between the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, but if you had to identify a body of water to start with,
right?
I wonder if the Mediterranean might be the simplest place.
Right, a nice, well-contained body of water.
Yeah, where most of the nesting beaches are known, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I actually think there's a move right now by the Mediterranean group, whoever they may be, to do an assessment. And I think there was some talk about perhaps getting them to do a quick assessment prior to pulling their Mediterranean green turtle population off the red list. But it just, I don't think it happened quickly enough. So, but I think there is.
This move was initiated by the folks in the Mediterranean
to pull the population off.
Yeah.
The red list? No, I think it was an executive decision by the two co-chairs and the red list authority of the Marine Turtle Specialist Group.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's why I was asking. I was asking how the Mediterranean folks felt about this, whether they, you know, they was a big tool for them to use for funding purposes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was curious.
Yeah, no, and I think we were supposed to discuss this issue at the most recent annual meeting of the Marine Turtle Specialist Group in Crete in April, and unfortunately, due to poor structuring of that meeting, we never had enough time to get into it, so it never was presented.
Basically,
or
ran
discussed.
Out of time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's at least. The good news is that there is now the push for regional assessments. It's going to be extremely complicated in terms of how it's going to be done.
Yeah.
I mean, just to sit down and think about it is a little mind-boggling.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned that people see it as a quick fix or an easy fix, but it's not really an easy fix because, like you say, coming up with a new set of criteria or way to do it is going to be quite challenging.
Right. And it's going to require help from a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I mean, we're, you know, really, I think the only way that we're going to get things like this done is to tap into the knowledge that the entire sea turtle community has. I mean, you can't count on just one person to pull this off.
Right.
Right.
It really requires everybody to sort of step up to the plate and participate.
Right.
Okay, so we were wondering, we had thought or wondered sort of in advance of doing this if we'd have enough material or how long this would go on for. We've now talked about red listing for 25 minutes or so.
Right.
So you guys have any final thoughts and we'll move on to something else? Or have you said your piece?
Ladies first.
I think I have said my piece. I think I've made all the points I really wanted to.
Right.
I mean, I'm just really curious now to see what the next step will be in terms of regional assessments and how that is, how, you know, the Marine Turtle Specialist Group is going to go about doing that. I think that sort of be a very exciting time in a way.
Yeah, I agree, and there should be lots of stuff happening in the near future on that. So, I guess stay tuned.
All right. So that's that on red listing. I'll go next with the next topic, and something that I wanted to talk about was all the issues that are popping up now with beach renourishment. And sort of the ironic part of this discussion, it's something that I've sort of seen coming since last year, with all the hurricanes that came through the southeastern United States and all the talk of erosion. It was clear that there were going to be lots and lots of properties that were in danger of falling into the ocean, so to speak. Lots of beaches were being washed away. And so typically, and this is not an unusual thing, so the coast is a dynamic area, like it's a dynamic place. Barrier islands even more so. Barrier islands actually migrate. They move very slowly over time, but they move. And we go out and we put houses on them, and then we expect them to stay in one place. The way that communities typically deal with this is they bring in, periodically will bring in heavy equipment to what they call renourish the beach. And so they'll pull sand from someplace else and they'll pump it onto the beach to increase the size of the beach.
Matthew has a really good blog on this showing how it works on the dredging and all.
That's right, yeah, and how they dredged up all that nice mud and put it on the beach, right?
Yeah.
So the problem that I sort of saw coming last fall was that this is not a unusual thing. I mean, this happens, or beach renourishment is a regular occurrence. But what I saw coming was a lot of places needing it at once, and there's only so much equipment to go around. And which basically meant that they normally do this in the wintertime. The reasons being that if they pump sand up on the beach during the summertime, it's going to have an impact on sea turtle nesting, on bird nesting. Many birds of which are on the endangered species list, sea turtles on the endangered species list. And so they try to avoid that, and they do most of the renourishment projects in the fall, late fall, winter, and early spring. And you guys can step in and correct me if I misstate anything. Clearly we were going to have a situation this winter where there just wasn't enough equipment to go around. We had a really bad hurricane season last year. People are worried and concerned for good reason that there's going to be another bad season this year. And they've seen that, you know, a bunch of their beach is missing. Their house is closer to the water. And everybody wants to get their shoreline shored up, so to speak. And the situation that we have now is that we've got a bunch of renourishment projects that are continuing on into the turtle nesting season, some that aren't even slated to start until the sea turtle nesting season. And I had pulled a bunch of recent articles going back to March or so of this year about some renourishment projects off of the news site, the news section of seaturtle.org. And then I noticed that one came up today. Actually, just 2 hours ago, this is from the Walton Sun in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, and the title was Walton County Beach Nourishment Suspended Until October 1st. And I'll just read a little brief intro here. It says, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers shut down Walton County's beach restoration project May 7th when a second Kemp's Ridley sea turtle was killed during dredging activities. Each Corps of Engineers district is allowed a certain number of sea turtles to be taken or killed each year during beach and aerosol projects. The Corps of Engineers consulted with the National Marine Fisheries Service and decided to suspend a project until October 1st, after the second turtle was killed, according to the Walton County Tourist Development Council. The TDC is expecting, that's the Tourist Development Council, is expecting a letter from the Corps of Engineers outlining the county's options to appeal the decision. The TDC will not speculate on if an appeal being granted. Will not speculate on if an appeal being granted. That's a bad sentence. The county and the city of Destin are looking into all available options to complete the nourishment project. Several area beach restoration projects have had trouble with sea turtles. Panama City Bay County project killed two Kemp's Ridleys and one loggerhead turtle. The Navarre Beach project took, this is a nearby beach, took one Kemp's Ridley turtle, according to the TDC. And many turtles have been relocated to safe areas during the nourishment ventures. According to the TDC, all three projects have relocated 78 loggerheads, 56 Kemp's Ridleys, and 4 green turtles. And this is just from one section of the coast. And what they've been doing is they've been running trawlers, trawl nets, mm-hmm. near the dredge head to try to catch turtles that might interact with their equipment, and they move them away. And obviously what's happened is that some turtles have gotten up in the equipment and they've run into problems because turtles and dredge equipment don't play well together. So, it could have seen this coming. Just a matter, I had said before that one of the main reasons that they don't want to do these renourishment projects during the summertime is because of the impact on the nesting beach. But, because it's nesting season, you also have large aggregations of turtles off the beach where you've got the dredge equipment, and so you have a higher likelihood of the equipment coming into contact with turtles. So
this is an unusual year, right?
Right, that's correct. I mean, these are things that go on every year, but usually don't get talked about that much. The thing that sort of bugged me about it was I could see from last fall that this was going to be the case, and also that nobody was dealing with the issue, in advance.
And you said the reason why they're doing it during the nesting season is because they didn't have enough equipment to go around and get it all done earlier?
Right, there's just not enough equipment to go around, and even in a normal year, often there are communities that don't get the Corps of Engineers doesn't get to. My understanding, I think, is that the Corps leases, there are companies that own the equipment, and the Corps leases it or subcontracts these jobs to these companies to do these renourishment projects. And there's just, there's only so much of this heavy equipment around, and there's a lot of beaches and communities that need this work done now because of all the hurricanes that we had.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of a double whammy.
Yeah. Can I just throw in a few more interesting tidbits?
Yeah.
It's interesting because in North Carolina, we actually have a state law that says that no beach nourishment activities can take place between April 1st and November 15th. And that's specifically to protect protected species such as shorebirds and sea turtles. And even plants, sea beach amaranth is an endangered plant that occurs on our beaches. And it's a pretty strong law, and we've been pretty good at keeping projects from occurring, even though there are, like you say, when you have lots of erosion from tropical storms and hurricanes, there's a lot of pressure from local municipalities to try to get nourishment projects done quickly and as soon as possible. But the law here is pretty good at restricting those projects to a time of year when there will have the least amount of impacts on both nesting sea turtles, their eggs that are incubating, and turtles in the water, because they tend not to be around during those winter months, at least in our waters. Florida, where a lot of these projects are taking place, there is no such state law that restricts nourishment to only certain months of the year. And I think it's partially a logistic issue because, in fact, they're pretty much sea turtles in the water all the time. And there are nests or nesting turtles there just about every month of the year, maybe December, January, February, there might not be any eggs or nests,
right.
or not very many. But leatherbacks start nesting in February, March in Florida, and mm-hmm. loggerheads are still laying their eggs, you know, in September, and it go all the way up until November, December before
right.
the eggs hatch. So,
it's a really small window to get things done.
Yeah, so there can be no window like that. But it's, I agree, it's a real conflict between turtles and development, basically.
Yeah. Well, so the thing that has sort of always bothered me about this is, you know, people sort of need to understand the dynamics of the coast. You know, I guess we can, you know, that might be a little too much to expect of, you know, just, you know, everybody to sort of have a grasp of the fact that, you know, the coast is a dynamic place and that it does slowly change over time. But, you know, there's, like in Florida, so there's another article here that talks about Governor Bush gets coastal disclosure bill. So that, you know, now they're talking about, you know, doing this full disclosure to prospective buyers of property on the coast so that they know, you know, exactly what the dangers are. Mm-hmm. Here it says, must disclose to buyers any information about the property's erosion potential as well as federal, state, or local environmental laws that regulate coastal development. Such laws include the delineation of the coastal construction control line, whatever that is, rigid coastal protection structures, beach nourishment, and the protection of sea turtles. So, you know, basically just making sure that buyers of property along the coast understand what they have to deal with and the fact that, you know, there are issues that may prevent them from renourishing or, you know, putting protective barriers in front of their home.
I am surprised that there would still be buyers of property along the coast.
Yeah, no kidding.
After last year. You know, the thing is, I guess I don't work in the U.S. and I work in other parts of the world where we don't deal with issues like this, or mm-hmm. I haven't dealt with issues like this. I always find this very intriguing. But what baffles me is why there are, or maybe there are, maybe I'm just ignorant, why there are no other initiatives to minimize beach erosion on a more, you know, in a more sustainable way.
Like what?
Like, you know, I have to come back and talk about this little study that we did in Melbourne Beach many summers ago.
Yeah.
You know, where we looked at the impacts of pilings and nesting sea turtles because it's a you know, sort of a stabler disc patented system that was developed to minimize beach erosion by basically dissipating wave energy during storms or, you know, or if you
right.
had really high waves. And so you sort of place these discs, anchor them into the beach and let the sand sort of build around it.
Right.
But the only thing was that they would have these pilings exposed, and so we did this study to look at the effects of exposed pilings on nesting turtles. And so that's what I'm saying, that I guess I'm not aware of other things like this being done more.
Well, the problem with that is, and this is something that I studied quite a bit actually when I was in graduate school, is that, you know, all these protective structures that you put along the shore, all they do is displace the effect to someplace else. I mean, and some of them aren't even effective at all. But, you know, things like groins or these sandbags they
right.
put out, you know, the energy is still there.
Right.
Things are still moving. You're just, you know, you're passing the problem down to the next person down the beach, basically.
Exactly.
That's true.
You know, exactly.
And,
that's true.
I mean, anybody who's been to a jetty, you can see the impact that jetty has on the local environment. On one
right.
side, depending on what the prevailing current's on one side, you'll have a massive buildup of sedimentation to the point that the land actually slowly moves out along the jetty. And on the inside of the jetty, or the leeward side, you'll have all the material is just accreting away and there's no deposition going on, and so the land retreats.
Right. But there are things to fix issues like this, right? Because they have, I guess they have pumps that can pump sand continuously when they build jetties so that doesn't happen, right?
Yeah. I don't know. But do you really want to be doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael talked about this earlier on when he was introducing it about how the coastline is just a naturally dynamic environment that
right.
comes and goes. And
battling Mother Nature, you know. I mean, yeah. This is just the natural process. It's the way things go. And
yeah.
You know, I guess my ideal, in the ideal situation, people would just understand that this is the case. And it's sort of like, you know, if you build your home in a floodplain, you expect that it's going to get flooded. The problem is, you know, insurance companies and the federal government come in and bail everybody out, and everybody else ends up paying for, you know, people making bad decisions, basically. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a really good hard solution, like Manjula's talking about, alternative to beach nourishment, would just to move the housing line way back.
Right.
So don't let people build their homes right there, right on top of the primary dune, but move
right.
it back.
Right.
You know, 500 meters or more, yeah. depending on the area, and that's really the only way you're gonna yeah. avoid this situation.
I agree.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I agree. I don't like this idea where we have to bail out this situation year after year after year. I mean, I live in a county where we have nourishment projects going on almost every year. I don't live on the beach. I live nearby, but I don't live on the beach, and yet still I have to pay taxes to support these projects that are basically benefiting the people who live right there on the beach.
Right.
So they can keep their homes there, and I totally disagree with that. And in fact, all three of us are also paying for these projects because a lot of federal money comes in.
Right. Yeah, every time there's a big disaster or, you know, national yeah. event of some sort, we all end up paying for it.
Right. But we also pay a lot just for the regular ongoing maintenance nourishment projects, although there is a move afoot to change that.
Right.
But we do.
Yeah, because doesn't in almost every case that I'm aware of, the Corps or FEMA or somebody like that subsidizes the project
yeah.
in some
yeah.
some form or fashion.
Yeah, actually, traditionally it's been up to 75%. It's been coming from federal dollars, but there's
right.
due to budgetary constraints that seems like it's going to change, or it has changed already.
Yeah. So maybe Michael mentioned this earlier, but what is the average amount of money that goes into a beach renourishment project?
Okay, here, I got it for you. I don't know about averages,
okay.
but
you better sit down, Modula, because
it's not a small amount. So there's a couple of stories that I grabbed. One, this is Naples News in Florida.
Right.
They talked about a $23 million Collier County beach renourishment project. So
yeah.
that's $23 million for the beaches in one county.
That's
just one project. Let's see. It doesn't say here, I don't think. No, I thought I had a few others here, but I don't see the numbers now. But, you know, all the ones I've seen have been, you know, $20 million, $13 million, $26 million. These are not small projects.
Yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah. Oh, wait, here's one that's $8.3 million for a beach renourishment project at Hunting Island State Park. So this is actually a relatively small project.
Yeah.
And it's just $8.3 million.
Just $8.3 million.
Right.
Imagine how many homes could you move back from that primary dune line for
right.
that same amount of money once,
right.
not every two or three years.
Right. And so, and here's a real sort of indictment of the problem in this story. This is from the islandpacket.com Hunting Island renourishment set for June. Hunting Island loses an average of 15 feet of sand a year, but violent hurricane seasons in the past 2 years have taken up to 50 feet of sand in some areas. So, you know, I mean, that's just Mother Nature doing her thing.
Yeah.
And
certainly if the hurricanes keep up like they have, you know, we're just not going to be able to keep up with it.
Well, and yeah, and you know, actually the nourishment project, like dredging and things like that, when you dredge, you interrupt the cycle of accretion and erosion. So in fact, once you start a dredging and nourishment project, you're pretty much committed to that for the rest of
right.
eternity.
It's not like erosion is going to stop, it just continues.
Right.
That's right, and you interrupt the process, like you're taking sand from somewhere to put it on the beach. You're removing it from somewhere else, so it's messed up the natural system, so you have to keep going in and doing this hard fix.
So how far offshore are they getting the sand?
It depends. Usually they have to do studies to find what they call a borrow site, a place that has sediment that's appropriate to put on the beach, and that really
right.
varies. So,
So what you're saying, Matthew, is that wherever they collect the sand from, that in itself affects the whole, the entire dynamics of the coast.
Right.
Oh yeah, there are cases here in North Carolina where they have to dredge inlets so boats can keep coming in and out, and they dredge that sand, and they usually put it on some developed beach somewhere, but that interrupts the flow of sand through the system, so right. Other undeveloped beaches are becoming more highly eroded than developed okay. beaches, and those yeah. undeveloped beaches are really important for wildlife too, so
right.
Yeah,
So they actually go and nourish those undeveloped beaches, if you can imagine, just to maintain those islands and those beaches, because they know that they serve a really important function for wildlife. So,
right. Mm. So I want to close off this topic with sort of a good news, bad news kind of thing. So this is another interesting story. So scientists fear this is. There's been I don't know if anybody's gets the hourly news update, sea turtle updates on seaturtle.org. You've seen a bunch of these lately with this kind of title. It says scientists fear South Padre Project will hurt sea turtles, and right. it's basically the same thing. You know, beaches were eroded by the 2005 hurricane season. I'm not sure where exactly this is, but it says the city hopes to, it's in Texas. The city hopes to begin a restoration project in May or June, which would mean vehicles moving over nesting grounds, sand possibly dumped over eggs or new sand in the surf, obscuring turtles' ability to find their nesting spots. So, you know, that's the usual story, but you go farther down in the story. It says, without major disturbances, this year promises to be a good one for nest finds. At least 25 had been discovered. This is Kemp's Ridley Nest. 25 Kemp's Ridley Nests had been discovered on Texas beaches this week, compared to 5 for the same period last year. By the end of April 26, the first day of the protection project, 10 nests were found. So, you know, that's another really, you know, sort of, so the good news side of this is that, you know, here we have Kemp's Ridley is apparently making a rebound in Texas. There's been a relatively speaking large number. Let's see what I got here. During 2005, a record 51 Kemp's Ridley nests were located on the Texas coast. And we've already had 28 this year. And the nesting season has just started. So I think it's actually higher than that now. This was as of May 4th, there were 28. And they actually had sort of a pseudo-Aravata, I think, in the Galveston area.
Oh, that's great.
Erin Sene was, I saw a bit from her. She's tracking some Kemp's Ridleys. I saw a story about this someplace, and they said that it was on a message board, actually, for a fisherman posted this message. And I'll put all these links and stuff in some show notes on seaturtle.org so everybody can find them. But basically talked about the fact that he had called in a nesting sighting to the turtle folks to come and see it, and they found 8 other nests on their way to the one nest this guy had found. So
that's very interesting.
So they didn't get to him for a while. which is, yeah, that's unusual for the Texas coast and Kemp's Ridley, so, but it's nice to see.
Right.
So
yeah.
So anybody else have anything on this topic?
No, it's a very interesting topic. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a big, is the U.S. one of the only countries that deals with this issue mostly, or?
No, there's massive beach armoring projects and things like that all around the world. I mean, just think of all
that's true. Beach armoring, there's a lot. Yeah. But in terms of beach re-nourishment at this scale?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
It's often used in Europe, and in fact, I don't know if you noticed that even on that little beach in Agia Pelagia in Crete, there was a little nourishment project going on where they brought in sand from some other source and dumped it on the beach and were spreading it out.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's commonly used in Europe.
Yeah, but then you know, and also think about all the shoreline that was armored there. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rock walls and all that kind of stuff that had been built right along the shore, and that changes the dynamics of the whole place, and those are permanent structures. You know, you think about all the harbors around the world, the big cities, the major cities that are right on the coast. I mean, they've completely, you know, they've basically paved over wetlands, what were wetlands at one point, and turned them into this hard, you know, a hard surface that's right on the coast.
Yeah, I guess I'm more familiar with beach armoring around the world rather than with these beach renourishment at this
Right.
scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they call beach armoring a hard engineering solution and beach nourishment a soft engineering
Right.
solution,
Oh,
but
that's interesting.
it's the same
Right.
idea.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think, as I said, I think the beach renourishment stuff has sort of flown under the radar, relatively speaking, for a long time because, most of the time these beaches have only need to be renourished every 2, 3, 4, 5 years, something like that. And we sort of hit, a bottleneck this year where so many places needed renourishment at once that it's caused a problem.
Right.
And it's starting to make the news.
Yeah.
That's true.
So
the conflict with sea turtles is not at what you're facing this season is not something that you face every nesting season.
Yeah, not this scale. I mean, I think, nourishment projects always run the danger of interacting
Yes.
with sea turtles. As Matthew said, in Florida, the turtles
Right.
are sort of always there. And so
Right.
anytime they do a nourishment project, you run the risk of interacting with them. But, they have mitigation measures in place. They have to get permits, and they have to do certain things to try to minimize any impacts, like the, trawling around the dredge head.
Right.
To intercept any turtles and things like that. So, they do, they take steps to try to prevent that. But this year it's just, they're doing it basically at the worst possible time for them in terms of their interactions with sea turtles.
Right.
So, okay. So that's that for that topic.
Great.
And I think we've chewed up a good bit of time. We're going on an hour here, so we should probably wrap this up.
Okay.
One of the things I was going to ask you guys about was if you know about any events coming up in the coming weeks that people might be interested in, any meetings you're going to or anything like that.
Manjula, world traveler.
Yeah, you're going. So you're always going someplace, aren't you, Manjula? Where are you off to next?
Well, actually, I'm off to Indonesia next for about 3 weeks at the end of this month. To just follow up on the nesting beach project in Irian Jaya.
Okay.
And sort of set it up for the nesting season and see what we're going to do this nesting season in terms of projects. We're going to experiment with the relocation of a few nests to see how that works out and how that compares with in-situ nesting, hatching. But in things, I surprisingly don't have very many.
Gotcha. So are we going to be able to get you to Skype from Indonesia?
I think maybe 1 week, maybe not for 2 weeks. But the main meeting coming up for me is the one in Gabon in mid-July, where it brings all the partners back for the second time to discuss how this attempt at coordinating our efforts went and what we're going to do for the next season. And this is the funding comes from the MTCA.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And the MTCA is for the viewers out there, listeners that might not know what that is.
It's the Marine Turtle Conservation Act, and it funds nesting beach projects all over the world. I'm not sure when the next deadline is, but I believe it's November 1st.
Right.
For proposals and applications.
I don't remember do you remember what their allocation is this year, or do they know yet?
I think it's around the same 700 or maybe 900,000, something like that.
I thought it was going to be a little higher this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll have to check.
For some reason, I thought it was higher, too, but I don't know what the final amount is.
Right. Well, maybe we can get Earl Possert or Mary Del Donnelly on to talk about it. That would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be very cool.
Okay, Matthew, you got anything coming up?
There is me
yeah.
coming up stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I got a meeting with you in early July in Baldhead Island to put satellite transmitters on turtles.
Right.
I'm trying to think what else is going on. I know that there's a sea turtle bycatch reduction workshop that's going to happen in St. Petersburg, Florida. Next week, I think it is May 18th.
Mm-hmm. Who's running that?
I think that's a National Marine Fisheries Service run workshop, but it's for all agencies and NGOs interested to mm-hmm. take part.
Gotcha.
There is also, they're talking about bycatch, sorry to interrupt Matthew. Isn't there the first workshop by Project Global in Argentina in June?
Yeah, it's coming up sometime soon.
Yeah.
I'll have to check. I should know. They're at Duke, so. I'll find out for the next broadcast.
Yeah. But nothing I can think specifically here in North Carolina.
Right, yeah. I was going to say, I can't think of anything really that's coming up. So, yeah. And I'm not going anywhere until, where am I going? End of this month, actually. Actually, that's about 3 weeks away.
Where are you off to?
I'm going to the Cayman Islands. Okay. And we're going to do a GIS/habitat classification workshop with the Department of Environment there. We're involved with in a project to delineate not just marine habitats, so coral reefs and seagrass beds and things like that, but also their terrestrial stuff.
University project?
No, this is actually with Brendan, Brendan Godley and Department of Environment. They got a Darwin initiative grant to look at biodiversity of the Cayman Islands. And part of that is to look and see what habitats they have. So we're going to try to map it out and provide a baseline
exciting.
What kind of habitat they have.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's great.
Fun stuff.
That's great. Are you going to visit the turtle farm?
I went to the turtle farm last time. I was there in late February, I think it was. That was my first trip to the Cayman Islands and my first trip to the turtle farm, which is pretty cool. Catherine Bell gave us a behind-the-scenes tour, so it was very nice.
That's great.
Cool.
So maybe we can get her on to talk about the turtle farm at some point, because there's a little bit of controversy in the news about the turtle farm right now.
Really?
I should say again.
I can't imagine that.
Seems to be something.
Yeah, maybe that would be an interesting topic to discuss, actually.
Yeah,
we should get CCC on there, too.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll work on that.
All right.
Okay, so that's it. And I don't know how we end these things, but I guess we'll just stop.
So great.
This is a weekly thing, right?
Yeah, we're going to try to make it. Yeah, so everybody that's still listening to us.
I thought it was daily.
Yeah, we're going to do this every day. No, we're going to do this. We're going to try to do this. We're going to try to do this once a week and hit some new topics each week, hopefully have some new people on. So if anybody out there, I'll just another a reminder, if you have any suggested topics or if there's a turtle person that you'd like to see us talk to, just send your feedback to feedback@seaturtle.org. And that's it. So what do you guys think?
Are we off the air?
Yeah, well, I'll just edit. I'll edit it out at some point.
I was pretty ignorant about deep sea nourishment, but that's okay.
I like the way you wrote your publication.
Yeah. I feel very clever.
Michael Pullman is the greatest guy.
All right.